welcome to the latest edition of the Mimiverse Monthly Audiocast. As always, I'm your host, writer-director Christopher R. Mim, and I have to know, are you there? Are you listening? And on a related note, do you care? Perhaps that's the most important question I should be asking you. Do you care? And if you do, and you claim to care, why have you not contributed to Demon with the Atomic Brain, the latest film I'm working on and am almost done? In fact, in 2 days from the recording of this particular audiocast, we will be filming one of the last scenes of the movie. And I don't necessarily mean the last scene as in the final scene in the film, chronologically, as when you watch it. No, it will be the final days of principal photography. Which means as long as everything goes according to plan this weekend, and the forecast isn't looking great, but we're going to shoot rain or shine, dang it. If everything goes to plan, principal photography will be complete, and I'll have all the footage I need to release another film, probably this year. In fact, if you've been a longtime listener, you've been with me, more or less, throughout this entire process, from when I announced the film through the writing of it, through the casting process. When we began principal photography at the beginning of February, here it is, June, and we're just now finishing up. The reason behind that had more to do with me being really busy. And some of the actors had stuff going on, too. We could only really shoot on the weekends, which is kind of odd when I started thinking about this. The last two films, Wereskido Nazi Hunter and this one, Demon with the Atomic Brain, were all shot on the weekends. Prior to that, I shot a lot on the weekends, but not so exclusively as I have with these last two films. Previously, we just shot more during the week. Shooting this film has been a bit spread out, more so than some other films. Granted, with this script, there's a lot of different locations, especially by comparison to Wereskido, which didn't have a lot of locations. And the locations we did use for Wereskido were like my living room. So we didn't have to build anything so much as we just had to decorate the room to look like a 1950s living room. Boom. We got our set. This one, we ended up having to build several sets. And that takes time. But again, I mentioned I was busy. I had a lot of conventions and screenings and stuff going on. So we couldn't exactly shoot every single weekend. It was rather spread out. We would shoot a weekend, then shoot the next weekend, and then 3 weeks off. And then come back. And then 2 weeks off. And then we'd shoot again. And then we had 3 weeks off. I mean, it was kind of insane. But we're coming up on the end of it. And I'm very excited to have it all in the can so that I can finish my film. And have another one under my belt. And I hope and think that all of you out there are going to like it quite a bit. I know what I have edited. And this was the other thing I was going to say before I tangented, which I do a lot. I don't know if that's a word, but I'm saying it. Because the shoot was so spread out and we were shooting on the weekends, that meant I had all the weekdays to spend time editing the film, which I've always done. But in this one, because there was so much time, I was able to get a lot edited. In fact, I have 40 minutes of the film complete. Not just temp stage, I mean complete. And that's the way I work. I'll film a scene and then I'll edit it together and add all the special effects and music and everything to it and be happy with it. Completely like, okay, this is the final version. Before I move on to something else. So once I finish that scene, it's done. I don't have to go back. I mean, sometimes I have to go back when I watch the whole thing. Sometimes I'll realize that perhaps I need to take something out or change something or just tighten something up. But generally, by the time I quote-unquote abandon it to move on to the next one, I'm done with it. So I guess it's not abandoning it. I guess it's more I just finish it and move on. So that's where that's at. 40 minutes of the film is edited. I have 2 days left of shooting it, and we're going to get it done this weekend, come hell or high water. And then over the summer, I should be able to finish it up, and we'll premiere it sometime, probably the first week of October. Last year for Wereskido Nazi Hunter, we premiered it during the last week of September, and I did that specifically because that following weekend it was already accepted into the Fargo Fantastic Film Festival, and so I was under a little bit of a deadline. This time, however, I think that I want to premiere it the first week in October, which would mean that we're looking at perhaps October 4th is a Wednesday, that first Wednesday in October. Yeah, I don't know exactly when we're going to do it. If maybe I've thought about perhaps trying to premiere it on a Saturday again, but that costs a lot more money, and I don't know that it'd be worth doing. Here's the thing about that. If you look at the premiere dates of most of my films, I think of the 11 that have been released, I've premiered only two of them on Saturday. We've never really had a lot of trouble premiering films during the week and filling seats. The Giant Spider, for example, was premiered on a Wednesday, and it sold out in 17 days. I'll say it again, we have not had trouble filling those seats during a weekday. In fact, we've had less trouble doing it Tuesdays and Wednesdays and Thursdays than we ever had doing it on a Saturday. The most recent time we did that was for the late night double feature, and that stressed me out. It was amazing how many people are just so busy on the weekends that they just cannot come to a movie, even though it's a premiere. It was like pulling teeth to get people to commit to that Saturday because it's starting to get nice. Graduations, proms, stuff happens. Funny thing is when I talked to the owner of The Heights, the place where I always premiere my films, and I said I wanted to do it on a weekend, having not really done it for years and years, he actually asked, why would you want to do that? And I said, I figure it might help getting people out to the theater. And he laughed. He said, no. The only people who really go to the movies on Saturday night are teenagers. And they're not there to watch the movie. And he's kind of right. People over the age of 18 who have families and lives and day jobs and whatnot don't necessarily want to spend their weekends in a movie theater. So it was kind of like pulling teeth to get people there. I mean, we did it, but it really came down to the wire on it. And it was kind of made me crazy. On the flip side, for many years, I would premiere the films usually on Wednesdays in May, and they would sell great. I don't think people necessarily mind going out to see a movie, especially when it starts at 7:30 and is over by 9. So realistically, we're probably looking at October 4th. I'm just throwing that out there, partially because you get it in your head, but then also because then I have a deadline to work toward. Sometimes I work better with deadlines, knowing that I have to get it done. Even though I've had over the years the discipline to get them done, I just still like having that deadline to a certain extent. Because there are days where I just don't feel like doing it. And I know that I more or less have to if I want to stay on the path of getting it done in time. So having that, knowing it's looming out there, this must be done by this time, motivates me to get it done. So I'm thinking October 4th. It's not set in stone. It still may end up being the last week in September. I don't know. See, one thing I learned, though, with Where's Keto Nazi Hunter was September is a very interesting month to show a movie. There's a perception, I think, with September that it's back to school. So people are more or less just getting back into the swing of being back in school or having your kids back in school or if you're a teacher, being back to work, whatever. So when we premiered Where's Keto Nazi Hunter last September, it didn't sell out. And it was the first time it didn't sell out since Destination Outer Space. And I still don't entirely know why. Perhaps the subject matter didn't necessarily grab people. Fatigue with the Mimiverse. I think it had a lot to do with the date change from May, which had become a tradition for a lot of people. And I hear that a lot. It's a tradition in our family. We go every year. So we were messing with tradition a little bit. But then September, everyone was kind of like, we're really busy. It's back to school. I heard that a lot. So I'm wondering if pushing it 1 week into October, it's the Halloween season, if the perception people have of where they are in their schedule and their routine and their calendar, if it being in October suddenly makes a difference. Otherwise, I may just hold it until next May. Which I hear you saying, no, don't do that. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do it in October. Demon with the atomic brain. Of which, being that we are so close to completion of principal photography, if you feel generous and want to make sure that you can go to the premiere and get a copy and get your name in the credits, contribute. The contributor program does not close down immediately. Once I finish principal photography, because even though it sounds logical that you're done shooting it, you don't need any more money. That's not true. Your contributions made, even after we finish principal photography, go to pay off debts. We never make enough money in contributions while we're shooting it to cover everything as it comes up. So at this point in the process, we're in the hole. where we've had to really dig in our pockets to pay for stuff for sets or costumes or whatever. So those contributions help us dig out of that hole. On top of that, there are still a lot of expenses. DVDs, for instance. Blu-rays, if we decide to do that. In fact, if we get enough money, I think I will release this one on Blu-ray. But it's all money dependent. It's more expensive to release a Blu-ray. So if I want to release it on Blu-ray instead of DVD, which I hear a lot of people asking for because everyone owns an HD TV these days and Blu-ray capabilities, they wonder why I haven't. It's purely money. It's just too expensive. It's outside of what we can afford at this time. On top of that, we have to pay for the premiere. There are posters, there are lobby cards, there are things that need to be made. The individually numbered collector tickets that we make for every premiere, the certificates that all the contributors receive, that stuff costs money to make. And that's what that money goes to. See, that's the thing. That's not much of a secret about the Mimiverse, is that it is not a lucrative business. I wish it were, but it's not. However, it is mostly self-sustaining. And that means that everything that's put into it comes right back out as more movies and more cool stuff. I encourage you, if you haven't contributed to the film, it's only $25. You get your name, or whatever name you'd like in the credits. You'll get that cool certificate, hand-signed. You get a copy of the film when it's done. And if you want, you can buy premiere tickets now to make sure that you get to go. I already have a bunch of people who've done this. So if you've never been to a Mimiverse premiere and maybe you want to make this your first, perhaps if you contribute now and you purchase premiere tickets, you'll finally say, all right, I'm going. I'm going to a Mimiverse premiere. I hear they're great because they really are. I try to talk about that a lot because they are. They're a singular experience. It's not just going to a movie. It's experiencing something new in a room of 400 people who like this stuff as much as you do. There's a palpable energy in the room that doesn't compare to anything else. It's literally the best way to see one of my films is at the premiere. And here's another thing. I don't let people see my films until I premiere it. And that goes for the actors in the film. So they're experiencing it for the first time. So if they're really awful, you can watch them cringe because they have no idea. But seriously, it's a great time. It really is. And I encourage everybody to do it at least once. Because at some point, there won't be any more. You know, things happen. Who knows? I can never guarantee that I'll keep making movies. I want to keep making movies, but, you know, life is what it is. Stuff happens sometimes. And I know that you have to look at things that way. Be grateful for the time you have and what you are given. And before you start to analyze this and wonder, oh my God, is he sick or something? No. I always get very philosophical as I reach the end of principal photography because once I have everything in the can, all I have to do is edit it together and I have another movie. But then I don't have anything else coming up. I finished that project. So I have to start another one if I want to. But there's no guarantee I will be able to or that I can afford to or that I even will want to. Who are we kidding? I'll want to. But that's my point. Treat every premiere as if it's your last. Contribute. Go to demonwiththeatomicbrain.com. That will take you exactly where you need to go, contribute to the film, and then come to the premiere. Dang it. So that's the most exciting thing I have to talk about this month. A few other things, I suppose. We did the 20th anniversary screening of It Came From Another World a week or two ago. And it was really fun. We had the Midnight Monster movies with Dr. Bob gang there doing a snark track, as they call it, so as not to infringe on any copyright owned by the Mystery Science Theater 3000 people. I thought it was hilarious. They just did great, and I absolutely loved it. I didn't actually read it or hear it or know what was going to be said before, so I was experiencing it with the crowd, and I was crazy happy about it. And I kept telling Bob Gilbert and Melanie Gilbert and Richard Haugland how amazing I thought it was. And it wasn't me just kissing their butts. I really, really was super impressed by it, and I thought it was so great. And I really cannot wait to put it on a future release, because that's the idea behind it, is that we're going to put it as a special track. Once we reprint It Came From Another World, and we're getting down to the point where we need to get some new ones made, so that's pretty cool, and I hope to also add an Esperanto track to it. So we're looking at some cool stuff in the future with It Came From Another World. Another cool thing that happened, and this was something that I kept close to the vest because I knew it was going to happen, but I really didn't tell anybody because I didn't want to believe it until it happened. Professor Jackson himself, Josh Craig, showed up. It was really great to see the guy because I haven't actually seen him in many years. He has a family, he has a life, he's been off doing his thing. Kind of, you know, our friendship kind of drifted apart and life is what it is. I don't blame anyone or anything. It just is what it is. But he was able to come out and it was super cool to see him again. And it was fun to have him around. And it was, I think for those people who were at the event, a lot of them were newer fans who weren't necessarily around during the earlier Josh Craig era of the Mimiverse. And so they never really had a chance to meet him or get him to sign something or whatever. And so for a lot of people there, I think it was kind of a cool treat to rub elbows with freaking Professor Jackson. Josh, if you're listening, thanks for coming out. It was really good to see you again. Maybe, just maybe, we should discuss getting you into another film at some point. Just putting that out there, universe. Make it happen. So yeah, we have some cool stuff coming this month to continue the celebration of the 10th anniversary of It Came From Another World by hosting a screening at the Alamo Draft House in Richardson, Texas on Friday, June 9th, 6:30 p.m. $5 at the door, and that $5 can be used as a voucher toward your food. So really, if you plan to go to the Draft House, see It Came From Another World, and eat, you're really getting in for free because you just get a $5 coupon toward your food and drink. Come see me. Say hi. Let's see if we can fill that one up. Then, and this is one thing I'm very excited about, June 23rd through the 25th, Monster Bash is an amazing convention that takes place in Pittsburgh that celebrates cheesy monster movies. And as the guy who makes cheesy monster movies, I think it's a good show for me to be at. And I'll be there. And so will Mitch Gonzalez, who makes all the monsters for me, Mark Hader, General Castle himself, Derek Cook of Monster Kid Radio is going to be there. We're trying to get Stephen Sullivan there as well. He wrote the Canoe Cops versus the Mummy book and many others. The point is it's a very cool gathering of like-minded Monster Kid types like us. I'm going to be there with a bunch of people. We're going to be selling stuff and hanging out. June 23rd to the 25th, you should come on down and hang out with us and say hi. At some point, we'll probably get sushi, and you should join us. All right, last thing to talk about. We have some cool new collectibles. We have the Monsters of the Mimiverse trading cards. They're selling crazy well, and I do believe that the next rare card will be available at Monster Bash. Card A was at the Monster of Phantom Lake the Musical DVD release party. Card B was at the It Came From Another World event just recently that I was just talking about. And card C will be available at Monster Bash at my table. So you got to stop by and pick it up. We have sets available again. We ran out and I got more made and we've again almost ran out. They're popular. The base sets are $20. They're available on the website, SaintEuphoria.com, under the collectibles section on the merchandise page. 25 cards, hand-designed by myself, and they're super cool. They're like old-school Mars Attacks cards. I'm very proud of them, and they look nice. They're high quality. They really are. So you should pick up a set and then start collecting the rare ones because you don't want to fall too far behind. Also, in honor of the 10th anniversary of the release of It Came From Another World, I've released a lobby card set for the film. Of the 11 films released to date, not if you include the musical, but that'll come at some point, I have released lobby card sets now for 10 of them. It Came From Another World made set number 10. The final set will be House of Ghosts and will most likely be released this year in time for Halloween. That's what I'm shooting for. The Monster Phantom Lake the Musical cards will probably follow at some point. And around the time that we release Demon with the Atomic Brain, we will have Demon with the Atomic Brain lobby cards. Pick those up. They're released in crazy, crazy small quantities. So you really need to jump on the bandwagon now. At some point, I may re-release them, but I may change them. And by that, I might change their size. I don't know. I have an idea. I'm not telling you about exactly what it is until I've released lobby card sets for all the films. Lastly, and this is something I'm very excited about, we started creating and releasing on-demand limited edition t-shirts. If you go to the t-shirt section at SaintEuphoria.com under merchandise, there is a design of a t-shirt. And much like those t-shirt places online that will release a single design and only have it available for a couple weeks, that's exactly what I'm doing. I've started creating these cool Mimiverse shirts that are only available to purchase off of SaintEuphoria.com. And once a design is released, it will only be available for 2 weeks. The first one we did was the Rock Monsters Curling Team, the official curling team of the Mimiverse, which the members of it are myself, Michael Kaiser, Mark Hader, and Stephanie Mim. So it is a true Mimiverse curling team. We even call the Rock Monsters. Our logo includes the monster of Phantom Lake. We released a shirt with that logo. We have these official shirts we wear to every game, and we released exact replicas to people who bought them. So you could sort of be an honorary member. That is no longer available. That expired. The current one celebrates the 10th anniversary of the release of It Came From Another World with a shirt for a company logo, quote-unquote, of the St. Marie Pie Company. If you remember, in It Came From Another World, there was a joke that Shannon McDonough said about how she made pie. And then Professor Jackson says something about her cherry is the best in the county. Well, the shirt says St. Marie Pie Company. It has a slice of pie on it, and then it says the best cherry in the county. I highly recommend picking up one of these shirts. They're only $15 and available in black or white, men's cut and women's cut, sizes small through men's XXX. Check them out. You only have until June 8th, 2017 to purchase the St. Marie Pie Company shirt. I highly recommend, if that sounds cool to you, pick one up. The only person right now who actually owns this shirt is Shannon McDonough, who played Julianne St. Marie. She got one as a going away gift for when she moved off to LA. So if you want to be like her, if she's your idol, you need one of these shirts. Go to SaintEuphoria.com, check out the merchandise section. It's under t-shirts at the very bottom of that page. There it is. So that's all I really have going on right now in the Mimiverse. Shortly, I'm going to send it over to Derek Cook of Monster Kid Radio. He has another edition of The Creature Connection. This time, the suggestion was made by yours truly. And it was a difficult one on purpose. I wanted to challenge the guy to really figure out a way to make it work. I'm not going to tell you if he does or not, because there's no suspense in that if I just reveal it. And then when we come back, I have Chapter 3 of For Your Ice Only, the novel I'm currently writing and releasing to you one chapter at a time, about international man of mystery Beef McCormick, who also moonlights as a championship-level curler. It's exciting stuff. We're on Chapter 3. And then, of course, we'll wrap up the show with another quote-unquote joke from Dr. Bob Tesla of Midnight Monster Movies with Dr. Bob. For now, I'm going to turn it over to Derek Cook. Derek, good luck.
People who know me, or at least spend just a little bit of time with me, know that my favorite film of all time is 1954's Creature from the Black Lagoon. It's an iconic Universal monster movie. I can't stop talking about it. I can't stop thinking about it. And the minute I think it might be playing anywhere, somewhere, TV, theater, drive-in, I can't stop watching it. I don't know if it's fair to say that I'm obsessed with the movie. Okay, I'm a little obsessed with the movie, but I love the film. The music is fantastic. The cinematography is beautiful. Of course, the monster design, the Gill Man, one of the best, if not the best, full-on bodysuit monsters of all time. The performances are great, and of course, I love my Julie Adams. Again, people who hear me on Monster Kid Radio know this is my favorite film of all time. However, every time I watch this movie, it occurs to me that Creature from the Black Lagoon is kind of the center of the classic monster movie universe. You can connect pretty much every classic monster movie to Creature from the Black Lagoon in just a few steps. My name is Derek M. Cook, and this is The Creature Connection.
Sheer stark terror grips you in underwater 3D in Creature from the Black Lagoon.
The most terrifying monster of the ages rises from the sea, raging with pent-up passion,
making every man his mortal enemy, every woman's beauty his prey.
Creature from the Black Lagoon in 3D. The most terrifying monster of the ages rises from the sea, raging with pent-up passion.
Every horrifying scene leaps out of the screen right at you.
Creature from the Black Lagoon in 3D.
Over the past past couple of months, I've been challenged to connect some American monster movies genre films to Creature from the Black Lagoon. And if you've listened to the previous two segments, I think I've pulled it off. However, Christopher R. Mim himself has challenged me, and this time he went a little outside the box. He challenged me to connect a Mexican monster movie, 1960's The Ship of Monsters. Normally, I'd play a trailer from the film right about now. However, I don't speak Spanish. I don't know if there's a Spanish language trailer for The Ship of Monsters out there or not, but even if there is, I have no idea what they're saying. And yeah, I'm just not going to do it. However, I will tell you this. Mexican monster movies are awesome. When you get into the late 50s and through the 60s, these Mexican horror films are amazing. Now, I'm a big fan of the luchador monster movies, Mil Máscaras, El Santo, Blue Demon, and all the rest. However, you don't have to have a wrestler to have a good Mexican monster movie. I'm thinking about movies like The Brainiac, which is just, wow. I mean, that monster alone should put Mexican monster movies right there on the map. But that's not the movie I was challenged with. I was challenged with a movie called The Ship of Monsters. And let's talk about that film for a second. From 1960. And it features a number of things that are tropes in Mexican monster or genre films. You've got, well, monsters that look very unique. Think Paul Blaisdell, but not as high a budget, but as much ambition, okay? So you've got these Paul Blaisdell-like monsters running around in this thing. And they're unique monsters to the Mexican monster movie culture. That's another thing that I like about Mexican monster movies is they have their own take on these monsters. Even a traditional monster like Frankenstein's monster, which you can find in 1970's Santo and the Blue Demon against the monsters, is familiar enough for us American movie watchers to recognize. However, it's also unique enough to be its own thing. First of all, it's not spelled traditionally as Frankenstein. It's actually spelled Frankuestein. I'm not sure if that's pronounced differently or not in Spanish. Like I said, I don't speak the language. Also, he's got a Fu Manchu mustache, and he drives a car. And that's just awesome! And again, unique to these Mexican monster movies. So you've got the monsters in The Ship of Monsters. You also have something else that you see in a number of, especially Santo luchador monster movies, aliens. And the aliens are typically very svelte, very well put together, very buff if they're men, or very sexy if they're women. And that's what you've got in this. It's a couple of very sexy extraterrestrial women. I believe they're from Venus on Earth looking for a man. Now, this movie also has something that you'll see in some other luchador monster movies, as well as just some other genre or B-movie pictures from Mexico from the era. You've got musical numbers. There's a musical influence in this film. So you have that as well. There's the science fiction elements. There's a little bit of comedy thrown in. Again, Mexican genre films had comedy. They had their own version of Abbott and Costello, kind of, sort of. But that's not the movie I was challenged with. Again, let's get back to The Ship of Monsters. Directed by a man by the name of Rogelio A. Gonzalez. And I apologize now. I probably should have done it at the beginning if I mispronounced any of the names. Now, Rogelio A. Gonzalez, he was primarily known as a director with over 70 credits to his name, but he also wrote a number of his own films as well as other movies. He also did a little bit of acting and did other crew work, that sort of thing. Again, keep in mind that the Mexican film industry was a lot smaller than the Hollywood film industry back then, so a lot of people had to wear multiple hats when it came to a production. Now, most of his films don't necessarily fit into that quote-unquote genre category. How he got involved with The Ship of Monsters, I'm not entirely sure. So he's not really going to be our step toward Creature from the Black Lagoon. However, somebody in the cast is. I mentioned the two extraterrestrials, the two Venetian women that come looking for a man. Well, they're played by Ana Bertha Lepe and Lorena Velasquez. Lorena Velasquez is one of the most important, in my mind, actresses when it comes to Mexican genre cinema. She did a ton of movies like Doctor of Doom or Wrestling Women versus the Aztec Mummy. She appeared in movies with some of our favorite luchadors as well, and appeared in a movie with somebody by the name of Fernando Osis. Now, Fernando Osis, he's another actor, writer, producer, director type. Now, Fernando did do a lot of luchador films, specifically a lot of Santo films. Now, he was involved with some non-luchador genre films as well, including a movie that was called La Señora Muerte, also known as Madam Death. And yeah, I can hear you chuckling at my pronunciation or attempted pronunciation at the Spanish title. So I'm just going to call it Madame Death here moving forward. Madame Death is directed by Jaime Salvador. It's about a mad scientist who is trying to help a disfigured woman look young and beautiful again by using other young women. Here's the interesting thing about Madame Death, and we see this with other actors as well in other countries. This film has an American actor in it, somebody who is associated with American genre cinema. I'm going to sideline, though, because this was not unique to Mexico. You actually saw a number of American actors who, you know, might have had moderate success here in the States go elsewhere to make movies. This is especially prevalent in a lot of the Euro cinema, Euro spy films, Euro horror films, things along those lines. You might actually see an American actor turn up over in the UK in a Hammer film, especially in the earlier Hammer days. This happened quite a bit. And sometimes a Mexican production would bring an American star or somebody associated with American productions into their films. I think probably the most well-known are the Boris Karloff films that were released right around or right after his death. He did a number of movies that were Mexican productions. He actually didn't go to Mexico, though. He actually shot most of his scenes here in the U.S., and then the other scenes were shot in Mexico, and they were combined in the editing room. Anyway, Madame Death didn't star Boris Karloff. It actually features John Carradine. But John Carradine actually opens the film, and this seems to be something that happened with not just this movie, but the next movie I'm going to talk about, where John Carradine appears on screen introducing the movie. And then later on in the film, he appears as a character as well. Now, at the very beginning, he's not really the character, but he might reference the character, that sort of thing. So we've got John Carradine, and that's our next step. John Carradine did at least one other Mexican monster movie, one with luchadors in it, Los Vampiros, featuring my man Mil Máscaras. Mil's my favorite luchador of these monster movies. Anyway, John Carradine. We're going to take John Carradine and use him just to get a little bit closer to Creature from the Black Lagoon. And honestly, not to take too much of the suspense away, it's not going to be that hard because John Carradine did so many films. The guy would act in anything, genre or otherwise. He was a working actor, constantly appearing on screen because he wanted to appear on stage. A lot of times he would take screen roles to finance his stage work, that sort of thing. So because John Carradine appeared in everything, it's not going to be too hard to connect him to Creature. I mean, obviously, he appeared as Dracula in House of Dracula and House of Frankenstein, which were Universal productions, so you could probably find some technical crew members linking those films to Creature from the Black Lagoon, because there's not a lot of time really separating those movies. However, I want to stick to the acting side of things. And again, Richard Denning, Richard Carlson, the two male leads from Creature from the Black Lagoon, you can get to John Carradine through a couple of steps, through them, through some things that they had done together. You can even get from John Carradine to Julie Adams through one step because they appeared in a movie together called The Killer Inside Me from 1976. This is a crime, small town drama, who's doing the killing and why kind of film. They both appeared in that movie as well, but that's a little bit more obscure, and I want to go straight to Creature. I want to go straight to John Agar.
Within 3 days, the dead will destroy all the living. I am from another planet, outside your galaxy.
I'm sorry, I just don't understand.
Unless Earth surrenders in 24 hours, we will begin a mass invasion. We are invisible. We are invisible, Adam Penner. You cannot see us.
From outer space come the invisible invaders, living dead men threatening to destroy all life on Earth.
John Carradine appears as Dr. Neumann in Invisible Invaders, and one of his co-stars is John Agar, who plays Major Bruce J. Invisible Invaders, it's a fun little movie. Actually, it just came out on Blu-ray not too long ago, I think maybe last year. It's got John Agar, so you know it's good, and it's got John Carradine, who's always awesome to watch. Well, I think it goes without saying, John Agar is the lead, the male lead, in The Creature from the Black Lagoon's first sequel, Revenge of the Creature. So there's your connection. Whew, kind of all over the place on that one. That was a tough challenge, Chris, but it was fun because I got to talk about some of the Mexican monster movies. I don't think I've actually talked about non-luchador genre films from Mexico on Monster Kid Radio proper, so this has kind of whet my appetite. I need to look into doing that later this year. Now, I'm going to be honest with you guys and gals. That's the last challenge I have on deck. So if you want to hear another edition of The Creature Connection, I'm up for it. I love doing this, but I need to know what movie you want to hear me try to connect to Creature from the Black Lagoon. And here's how you do it. Email me at monsterkidradio@gmail.com or send me a voicemail at 503-479-5657. That's 503-479-5MKR. Of course, you can hear me every week on Monster Kid Radio over at monsterkidradio.net, where I'm always talking about the classic and sometimes not so classic genre cinema of yesteryear. And as of right now, we're actually running the 2017 Monster Rally Retro Awards. If you head over to tinyurl.com/RALLIES2017, you're going to be taken to a ballot to where I'm asking you to help us decide who is the best actor, actress, monster, director, and we'll just find out what the best movie was in fantasy, horror, and science fiction in 1933, 43, and 53. The deadline for the Rally Awards is June 30th of this year. Thanks to the Columbus, Ohio surf band Mumula for letting us use their song Black Lagoon from their album The Rise of Mumula as the theme music for The Creature Connection. You can find them at mumula.bandcamp.com and pick up their album for $7. Thanks to Chris for giving me a platform for The Creature Connection on his podcast. I hope to see you over at my podcast. I'm Derek M. Cook, and this was The Creature Connection.
Thank you, Derek. I'm glad you enjoyed my challenge. I figured if anyone would get this, you could make this happen. And of course, you did. And I'm glad you had a good time. All right, so now is the time in the show where we get to our ongoing serial. This is, of course, For Your Ice Only, my novel I'm currently writing, and you guys get to hear every month, chapter by chapter. It's about international man of mystery Beef McCormick, whose cover is that of a very, very talented world-class curling star. We're on Chapter 3. At the end of Chapter 2, Ivan Bentonov, the Russian curler assassin, tried to blow up the curling arena with Beef McCormick in it, but failed. So instead, he went with Plan B, which was to use his curling broom sniper rifle. So here is Chapter 3. Chapter 2 ended with Bentonov pointing a sniper rifle at Beef McCormick's face as he exited the curling arena. So, here we go. For Your Ice Only, Chapter 3. Once news began to spread through the crowd that Beef McCormick, famed skip of the American team, had somehow disabled the incendiary device set to drop the roof of the curling arena on their heads, celebrations began to erupt. What began as isolated pockets of voices rapidly and exponentially grew into an ear-splitting roar of approval. Beef, still kneeling in front of the bomb rock, slowly stood and raised his right hand in a humble wave, a gesture met with thunderous applause. Beef's vice skip stepped to his side and clapped him resolutely on the shoulder. Beef couldn't help but smile a weary grin before letting out a tension-dissipating sigh of relief. Emergency service personnel began to flood into the stadium and tend to the weak of constitution and those suffering from the myriad of bumps and bruises sustained during the panicked rush to escape. Having avoided an ugly, untimely death, an electric wave of joy washed over the assemblage. Families hugged their members tightly, grateful to be alive and ready to approach their futures with greater senses of purpose. Lovers embraced, and at least one or two men hastily proposed, only now realizing, once met with the possibility of losing their sweethearts, they could no longer go on without their beloveds taking their names. Finally, and most importantly, several children, unsure of what exactly was even happening but astute enough to understand it was important, with a capital I, decided then and there that when they grew up, the best thing they could ever become was a curler. Anger began to bubble in Beef McCormick's stomach and churn up into his throat. Someone had clearly tried to assassinate him, and although it wasn't uncommon in his less publicly known line of work, attempting to do so in such a public way and at the risk of killing an auditorium full of innocents didn't sit well. Deep down inside, he suspected Ivan Bentonov must have been involved, if not responsible. In a last-ditch, futile exercise in optimism, Beef scoured the crowd, hoping against hope to find the Russian curler amongst the faces and potentially clear his rival's good name. Beef cared deeply about and respected those who dedicated themselves to the noble sport of curling, and Ivan Bentonov was one of the best. However, Beef knew there was no other explanation for Bentonov's sudden disappearance at the exact moment Beef was to deliver the malignant modified stone. Still, he hated to think that a man of such skill could also be so indifferent to the potential loss of so much life. The arena was mostly clear now, with but a handful of stragglers milling about searching for lost items or praying thankfully to the heavens. Beef's team had shuffled out, but he remained behind as the local police department's bomb squad secured the explosive device. Satisfied that everything was under control, he finally made his way toward the front exit. He carefully opened the front door and stepped out into the gray, brutally cold winter air. He wasn't wearing a coat, but he didn't care. Having come so close to losing his life, again, the rush of endorphins and dopamine sustained and warmed him in the bitter chill. He took in a deep lungful of freezing air and held it, letting it stew in his body heat before exhaling it into a life-affirming puff of vapor. A young woman holding her small child, both wrapped together in a blanket provided by the ambulance by which she stood, noticed Beef McCormick at the top of the stairs leading from the main entrance to the arena. Elated, she cried out, "There he is!" Heads snapped toward the hero of the hour, and almost simultaneously, every voice erupted in a vivacious cheer. Beef blushed at the sound. He wasn't used to receiving such blatant praise for his work outside of the ice, mostly because being a spy meant making sure no one knows what you actually do. Despite the outpouring of positivity, Beef found himself on edge. He knew his would-be executioner was still at large, and if this monster was willing to murder thousands of people just to get to one, he certainly wouldn't give up after a single failure. As a result, Beef's finely honed mind began to crunch numbers, run through scenarios, and calculate probabilities. He mentally projected himself into the shoes of his nemesis and asked, "Where would I be? What would I do?" Within nanoseconds, the obvious answer materialized, and Beef turned his attention onto higher ground. He surmised that if his adversary stuck around to verify whether his dastardly scheme had gone according to plan, he'd have to stay close by, yet safe from any potential debris or extraneous shrapnel. Conversely, should the attack be thwarted, he would need somewhere advantageous to implement a plan B, a plan most likely less grandiose and much more direct. Beef scanned the area and quickly realized the best candidate for such a place was the snowy hill on the opposite end of the expansive parking lot. At the top was a stand of solid, old-growth trees, which, in theory, should be able to take the brunt of an acute explosive shockwave. Also, should the bomb fail to go off, the oaks would provide the perfect hiding place to... Sometimes Beef hated to be right. There he was at the top of the hill. Ivan Bentonov, Beef McCormick's nemesis on the curling sheet, kneeling behind a tree, aiming what looked like a curling broom modified into a sniper rifle, right at Beef's face. The next few seconds moved at a snail's pace. Beef's perception of time elongated by the pure adrenaline flushing through his bloodstream. His heart felt like the engine of a race car being flooded with fuel and fire. A light flashed from the end of Bentonov's makeshift gun at the exact same moment Beef lowered his head down and to the right. The distant pop of a gunshot echoed through the frigid air, and a zoom of superheated wind zipped too close for comfort past Beef's left ear. The white hot slug slammed into the entrance of the arena with a dull, reverberating thud, the force of which shattered the door's thick window. It splintered into thousands of tiny shards which blew outward and onto the poor souls close enough to be caught in the expanding cloud of glass. "Everybody get down!" Beef yelled out. Panic took hold of the crowd and people began to run in haphazard directions. Beef watched as Bentonoff lowered his weapon. Even from this distance, Beef could plainly see the outraged frustration on Bentonoff's face. Seemingly autonomically, Beef's exquisitely toned legs carried him full force toward his Soviet antagonist. Several random people stepped into Beef's path, but, Beef being the consummate professional and all-around good guy, he deftly avoided each one, never once losing his stride. He looked up to find Bentonoff rooting through what appeared to be a broom bag on the ground near his feet. As Beef reached the bottom of the hill, Bentonoff's hands began to shake. He hastily tried to reload his broomstick rifle, but the combination of the terrified screams below and Beef's fast-approaching, snow-crunching footsteps was too much. As the next bullet clicked into place, Bentonoff violently crammed the chamber shut and swung the muzzle toward the approaching American curling star. Luckily, in that short period of time, Beef had closed the gap completely. Beef wrapped his left hand around the business end of the weapon and, just as Bentonoff pulled the trigger, shoved it skyward. Another percussive bang rattled into the distance, the people below wailing and hollering in response. The excessive heat caused by the blast conducted through the metal shaft burned Beef's palm, but he did not let go. Instead, he leapt into the air and, with all of his might, drop-kicked Bentonoff in the chest, sending him hard onto his back and into the powder. Beef twisted in midair and, cat-like, landed right side up on his hands and knees and facing away from his foe. Laid out in the cold snow, Bentonoff clawed at his chest, the ferocity of Beef's attack having sent his diaphragm into spasms. He gasped for breath, but his efforts were momentarily for naught. Beef regained his footing and spun to face his enemy. Still holding the curling broom rifle, he chucked it into the distance with a fervent grunt, the scorched skin of his palm stinging as it began to blister. Reaching down, he grabbed an excessive handful of snow and clenched his fist around it. The intense cooling sensation provided a momentary respite from the pain. "Get up, Bentonoff!" Beef snarled. His respiration returning to normal, Bentonoff worked through the pain and disorientation to bring himself to a crouching position. Saying nothing, he glared at the man he was tasked with ending, incensed to have failed so spectacularly. "I said get up!" Bentonoff bared his teeth and scowled himself into a standing position, his pupil shooting daggers through Beef McCormick's eyeballs. "Who do you work for? KGB?" Beef aggressively inquired. Bentonoff remained silent. "Who do you work for?" Beef's temperature began to rise, and Bentonoff could literally see the steam of frustration wafting from the top of his opponent's head. He couldn't help but smirk. "Wipe that smile off your face before I do it for you." Bentonoff's grin blossomed into a full-blown belly laugh. Having had enough, Beef raised his fists and charged full speed at the guffawing Russian. Once close enough to engage, he unleashed a fierce left hook toward Bentonoff's eye socket. Bentonoff blocked it with ease, but, like lightning, Beef rammed the knuckles of his right hand into Bentonoff's gut. Caught off guard, Bentonoff instinctively grabbed his midsection and stumbled backwards. Beef advanced on him, continuing his ferocious assault by connecting a series of left and right uppercuts into Bentonoff's chin. Again, Bentonoff flopped backwards into the snow with a sickening whoomp. Scarcely conscious, Bentonoff scurried backwards, barely avoiding being stomped by a rampaging Beef McCormick. However, it wasn't enough as Beef landed a few solid kicks to Bentonoff's liver. Growing desperate, Bentonoff rolled away and swiftly smashed his foot into the back of Beef's knee. The sheer force of it made Beef's leg buckle, and he, too, was sent to the ground. Taking advantage, Bentonoff leapt to his feet. Beef followed suit and was quickly upright. The two faced each other, both now covered in splashes of white powder, their breath coming in ragged wisps of steam. Obviously in extreme pain, Bentonoff held his throbbing right side. Enraged but lucid, Beef McCormick demanded an answer. "Why?" Bentonoff was startled by the question. "Why? Why do you ask why? Why what? Why are you trying to kill me?" "It is what I do." "Who do you work for?" "It is not important. I know who you are, Beef McCormick." "I don't think you do. I'm just a curler." Bentonoff chuckled at that. "Well, so am I." Suddenly, a blinding circular shaft of light shone down from the heavens and engulfed the two men. Shocked, Beef twisted at the waist and, looking up and behind, shielded his eyes from the brightness. He felt the briefest sense of surprise and disappointment for being so focused on his fight that he was able to completely tune out the sound of an approaching news helicopter. No matter, Bentonoff was wounded, and now that the eyes of the world would be upon him, there was no escape. Beef turned back toward his Russian adversary and found him digging through the broom bag lying on the ground. Upset by his lapses of focus, Beef used his self-reproach to push himself full tilt toward Bentonoff. He covered the ground between them in a flash, but Bentonoff got the drop on him this time. Pulling a broom from the bag, Bentonoff cracked the head hard against Beef McCormick's temple. Beef's body flew sideways through the air and bounced like a rag doll through the fallen snow. The world spun and darkened around the edges. Beef's fingers and toes went numb and his limbs disappeared from his perceptions. Barely holding on to consciousness, Beef watched as Bentonoff stepped to the center of the blinding spotlight. He pointed the head of a red-handled curling broom at the helicopter and activated a hidden mechanism. Remaining attached to the handle via a strong, expanding silver cable, the head launched upward with a tinny gasp. Finding its target, the head connected and adhered magnetically to the underside of the hovering machine with a loud clunk. Bentonoff turned to look Beef McCormick in the eye.
"Next time we meet, Beef McCormick, I will kill you. For now, I let you live, if only so you may wallow in your shame."
Bentonoff pressed an unseen button, and a metal stirrup erupted from the bottom of the broom handle. Placing his foot into the stirrup and tightly grasping the shaft with both hands, he clicked another button, which caused the cable to retract. With a shrill whir, Bentonoff disappeared upward and out of Beef's field of vision. As darkness enveloped Beef McCormick, the last things he experienced were the nauseating cracks of the helicopter's flight crew's bones breaking as they hit the ground, and the rush of wind caused by the rotor blades spinning up and away. All right, that's it for Chapter 3 of For Your Eyes Only. Let's hope this keeps going. I had asked people to let me know if they enjoyed it or not, and whether or not I should continue after the first couple chapters, and honestly, I've heard from a lot of people who really do seem to like this, so I'm going the distance. I'm going to write a novel. I don't know how many chapters we'll end up with, but we got 3 under our belts. Let's see where this ends up. Thank you very much for listening to the Mimiverse Monthly Audiocast. I am, as always, your host, writer-director Christopher R. Mim. Don't forget to go to SaintEuphoria.com and contribute to Demon with the Atomic Brain. Maybe pick up some of those It Came From Another World lobby cards, or some Monsters of the Mimiverse trading cards. They're not going to last forever. And I hope to see you at an event this month. If not, I hope to see you somewhere along the line. And don't forget, as I always say, be good. But if you can't do that, be good at it. Talk to you next month. For now, Dr. Bob Tesla of Midnight Monster Movies has a joke to tell. Dr. Bob?
It is I, Dr. Bob Tesla, with your Mimiverse Joke of the Month. A farmer walks into a hardware store and asks for a chainsaw that will cut down 6 trees an hour. The salesman recommends the top-of-the-line model. The farmer is impressed and buys it. The next day he brings it back and complains they would only cut down 1 tree and it took all day. The salesman takes the chainsaw and says, "Okay, sir, let's see what's wrong with it." And he starts it. And the farmer says, "What's that noise?" "Make sure you come out June 10th to the Gateway Film Center when we will be showing Manos, The Hands of Fate. It's one of the most infamous movies of all time, made by a fertilizer salesman, so there's that going for it. But we will be presenting it in Debbie-rama. You want to know what Debbie-rama is? Well, you better come out to the show and find out. And as always, check out at www.midnightmonstermovies.com for more details.